you feel like it's more real, especially since it's a wider angle. You know, it's not trying to move in any particular kind of way. So I felt like it added more than it detracted from this fight scene.
This is the Action Filmmaking Decoded Podcast. A podcast dedicated to raw action analysis.
Ooh, my gosh. For fans of action cinema out there, how badass would that be?
Each week, we bring you a new action filmmaker to break down your favorite scenes.
360 off person, round kick the guy from a 360 spin.
Now, introducing your hosts, Darren Tun and Mike Messina.
Hello and welcome to the Action Filmmaking Decoded Podcast. I'm your host, Darren Tun, and with me is my co-host, Mike Messina.
Hello.
Today we have episode 3 of the AFD News section. Yeah, and today we're covering a whole bunch of stories, some of them including Spider-Man No Way Home, the trailer, Matrix 4, Resurrections, and Cowboy Bebop. And then after this, we'll have a short section going over the Shang-Chi bus fight breakdown, which is going to be released today, if you're listening to this at the time of release.
Yes, and before we get into the more fun stuff, there are some more unfortunate news headlines that we felt we had to address here. So the first one has to do with some global international news, some current events that you've probably heard of to some extent. The headline reads, Afghan film progress obliterated by Taliban takeover, a special report from Afghanistan. This is coming from Holly McKay of Deadline Hollywood, and I'm going to be paraphrasing that article here. As soon as the insurgency took control of Kabul's presidential palace and declared themselves the rightful leaders last weekend, those hard-earned gains were shattered in an instant. The steadily evolving and critically acclaimed Afghan film and television industry now belongs to the graveyard of memories. Quote, great terror has been spread in the streets and back alleys of our country. The Taliban are hostile to educated people, including journalists, arts, filmmakers, and poets. End quote. That's from a leading Afghan movie maker who asked only to be identified as Sharafat as he attempted to leave the country with his family, he told the author last Wednesday. And then there's one more quote from the article. Our language is closed. Music is not allowed, let alone filmmakers in Afghanistan. So this is now Mike and Darren speaking about this article. Really bad news. You probably heard at some point about the Taliban retakeover in Afghanistan that just happened and the U.S. troop withdrawal. And, you know, in addition to the horrible things that happened to the people who live under that regime's rule, there's also the repercussions here for artists, especially any artists who have spoken out against that style of ruling, that Taliban ruling in the past. I know that a lot of the burgeoning film scene there was from some real trailblazing ladies, some female film directors and writers and actors who were really telling some poignant stories there. A lot of dramas coming out of Afghanistan in recent years. And then there's one other story on the same topic that we wanted to read off here. Afghan director asks for support from international film community. Our expression will be stifled into silence. This is coming from Chris Lindahl of IndieWire. Karimi, who in 2019 was appointed the first woman to lead the state-run Afghan film company, posted a letter on Twitter on Friday. In it, she pleads with members of the international film community to use their voices to fight the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan. From the letter, quote, everything that I have worked so hard to build as a filmmaker in my country is at risk of falling. If the Taliban take over, they will ban all art. I and other filmmakers could be next on their hit list. They will strip women's rights. We will be pushed into the shadows of our homes and our voices. Our expression will be stifled into silence, she wrote. Again, quoting from the letter, please help us get this world to care about what is happening to us. Please help us by informing your country's most important media what is going on here in Afghanistan. Be our voices outside Afghanistan. And again, this is going to be Darren and I talking about this bad stuff going on there. Again.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
It's actually kind of crazy because if you really think about it, a lot of these filmmakers and documentary creators are actually very crucial to at least us being able to find out more about what's going on and their experiences and stuff like that. And shutting down those voices becomes really detrimental to, and we lose a lot of those stories.
Definitely. A lot of the movies that we as in US or Western filmmakers make are just inherently through a different lens, right? We're from an outsider looking into a place riddled with conflict, and we need to hear those stories about what it's like to live there and what goes through someone's head living in that kind of a situation. And now we're not going to get that in addition to just those hard things, those horrible things, and, you know, that new regime coming to power again, happening all over again.
Yeah. So on another sad note, we have Sonny Chiba passes away. This was an article written by Yuri Kageyama. Sonny Chiba was a Japanese martial arts legend and Kill Bill star. He died at the age of 82. He wowed the world with his martial arts skills in more than 100 films, including Kill Bill. He died late Thursday in a hospital near Tokyo, where he had been treated for COVID-19 since August 8th. It was said that he had not been vaccinated.
Yeah, so I honestly didn't really know who Sonny Chiba was before this story came out. He is, of course, most known, at least in the West, probably for his role in Kill Bill 1 as Hanzo, the sword maker that Uma Thurman's character approaches and meets early in that film. And then looking back at his action reel, he does a lot of old school martial arts, Bruce Lee-esque films and screen work there.
Next up, we have Ed Asner dies. TV icon who played Lou Grant was 91. This is an article written by Nelly Andriva from Deadline. Ed Asner, legendary actor, activist, and philanthropist, passed away peacefully Sunday morning. Surrounded by his family, he was 91 years old. Asner, former president of the Screen Actors Guild, is best known for his role as Lou Grant on both the Mary Tyler Moore Show and its spinoff Lou Grant. Asner's long list of credits also include the movies Elf, one of several movies in which he played Santa Claus, and Pixar's Oscar-winning Up, in which he voiced the lead, Carl Fredrickson. His most recent major roles included arcs on several Emmy-nominated comedy series on Netflix, Cobra Kai, playing Johnny Lawrence's stepfather, Sid Weinberg, Grace and Frankie, and Dead to Me. Asner's extensive voiceover resume includes providing the voices for J. Jonah Jameson on the Spider-Man series, Hoggish Greedley on Captain Planet and the Planeteers, and Ed Winkler on The Boondocks.
Like, again, I didn't really know too much about Ed Asner until, again, this headline, unfortunately, but I've seen Elf. I loved Elf. Up, of course. You know, Spider-Man TV series from the 90s was huge for me. And then I know Captain Planet and the Boondocks as well. Both series are really huge staples in pop culture. And of course, Cobra Kai, which we're both very avid fans of. And then on top of that, he was also Screen Actors Guild president. So not only representing actors really well on screen, representing them in the real world. And there was another story that we saw where he had a SAG-AFTRA health plan lawsuit that was in effect. And even after his passing here, it still looks like it's going to be holding up in court, some discrepancy about who's being represented in that health plan. But shouts to him, he did a lot more than what he is known for, which is being on screen.
It's crazy to hear that he's been doing like all these different works that you've never heard of, and especially his voice acting work. It's like, man, Carl Fredrickson from Up, like that was him.
People love Up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Everyone loves Up.
And when you mentioned Johnny Lawrence's stepfather, that was pretty crazy because I remember he played a pretty small role in there, but it was quite crucial to, I guess, Johnny's development. So I'm wondering what they're going to be doing with Cobra Kai season 5. Speaking of Cobra Kai, our next article is Cobra Kai renewed for season 5 ahead of season 4 release. This is an article written by Rosie Cordero. Netflix has renewed Cobra Kai for season 5 ahead of its fourth season premiere in December. Production on the new season is set to begin in Atlanta this fall.
I guess it's notable that it's been renewed ahead of the season 4 release. So we didn't even see season 4 and they already brought it back for season 5, which hopefully is a good indicator, a good omen that season four
is going
to
be great.
Cool. Pumped to see Terry Silver taking the Cobra Kai stage. And then there's another small story here about Karate Kid as well.
On more Karate Kid news, we have Karate Kid, the musical sets 2022 pre-Broadway run. This is an article written by Greg Evans. The stage musical adaption of the 80s classic, The Karate Kid, will pick up its world premiere in St. Louis next spring in what producers are calling a pre-Broadway engagement. With a book by original screenwriter Robert Mark Kamen and music and lyrics by Drew Gasparini, will be a limited engagement on May 25th, 2022 in a Stages St. Louis production at the Kirkwood Performing Arts Center.
I love musicals, dude, but like I'm a little worried.
Yeah, yeah.
A little worried.
It's the first action musical, man. That's what it is.
I do remember hearing about Spider-Man. I think Turn Off the Dark was the name. It was a Spider-Man action Broadway thing.
Yeah.
I heard it was horrible.
Oh, really?
I'm sorry if anyone listening worked on it or loved it or anything. I personally didn't see it, but I heard some not so great things about it. So hopefully Karate Kid here can do it a little bit better.
Yeah. All right. Next in news is Francis Coppola, a gambling maverick movie maker who won big betting on star cast for Epic Megalopolis. And this is a new movie I think he's trying to get into the works. At 82 years of age, is once again taking some financial risks and making this movie that's going to cost between $100 million to $120 million. He's worked on many, many films, as you've known. The Godfather trilogy, Apocalypse Now. Yeah, just a whole bunch of works. And the cast is looking like, at the moment, Oscar Isaac, Forest Whitaker, Cate Blanchett, and John Voight, with possibly Zendaya, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Jessica Lange, just a couple to name.
Of course, Francis Coppola is a legend in filmmaking business. It's really cool to see, A, that he is getting kind of old, but he's still kicking. He's still chasing dreams or chasing whimsies, as Kevin Smith would say. Yeah, that's the part that I really like about this, I think. It is an example of someone who has this big, lofty dream, but someone who has the credentials and apparently the cash as well to really make it happen. And yeah. I think some of the articles are mentioning this too, but it's kind of obvious. If you're an actor and you're tapped by Francis Coppola to be in one of his films, you take that opportunity. Yeah. That is huge.
Yeah.
I wonder if... So there's an upcoming sci-fi epic called Dune, which is going to be directed by... Villeneuve? Is that how you say him?
Villeneuve.
He directed the newest Blade Runner. He did Sicario. He's awesome. Yeah.
Just like wonder, that whole genre of sci-fi, I think he's very into.
Yeah. I do wonder if how Dune performs this coming, I think, October. I wonder if that'll have any bearing on whether or not Francis Coppola here can get the green light on his sci-fi epic, because that looks pretty expensive as well.
Yeah, and it's kind of crazy because there have been quite a few sci-fi big budget films in the past that haven't done as well with like a huge budget behind them and a lot of people kind of riding on its success. But it's hard for a lot of these things to pop off in the way, you know, Star Wars did or Star Trek did in a whole bunch of different movies. Blade Runner, you know what I mean?
Yeah, especially now because new installments of Blade Runner or Star Wars, that has an install base. That's an existing IP. Here with Coppola trying to get it, I think, an original IP off the ground, that's going to be a gamble. That's going to be rough.
Yeah, but I'm excited to see how it turns out. I always love it when people take big risks like this.
Fingers crossed for him.
Yeah. All right. Next up, we have The Expendables returning for Lionsgate with Sylvester Stallone, Jason Statham, Dolph Lundgren, Megan Fox, and more.
Yeah, I got to rewatch the older ones. I remember not being super crazy about the old movies, other than the fact that obviously their gimmick is so fantastic, which is all of these incredible action stars coming together. The only thing
in one movie and Scott Adkins too.
Right? And Scott Adkins was there for a minute. I wish he had a little bit more. I feel like he was underutilized, but cool having him in there at all. I do wish we had some more Donnie Yen, Jackie Chan kind of action for the Expendables.
Right,
I know there was
a
whole thing there of them not being a part of the franchise, but who
it
knows,
seems
you
like
know,
a lot
day.
Of lot of American action stars, but I know Jet Li was also in it as well.
That's true. That is a good point. Yeah.
And here it also says, in addition, we have 50 Cent coming in and Tony Jaa.
I'm a little upset that Tony Jaa is not in the headline with some of the other people here. Like, he is, of all the action stars, he might be the most credentialed out of everyone here.
Next up, we have Mission Impossible 7 stunts may be the biggest in movie history. This was an article written by Jermaine Lussier. The film is scheduled for release May 27th, 2022. During Paramount's presentation at CinemaCon 2021, exhibitors were treated to a 10-minute video detailing Cruise's latest stunt. This one will see him drive a motorcycle off an actual cliff, jump off the motorcycle in midair, free fall a few seconds, and then parachute to the bottom of a huge gorge. And of course, it's actually Tom Cruise doing this, not a stunt person. So he had to practice and train a lot to be able to pull this off. But I remember Christopher McQuarrie was also saying that it's not only about crews being able to do the stunt, but it's also about being able to record it well and in the way that they want it to.
That's a really funny point. It's like Cruise is like, yeah, then we're going to go to the moon and I'm going to jump off and I'm going to free fall to Earth. And like, yeah, that sounds great, Tom, but we need to get cameras on it. We can't just let you do anything.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, well, we're just going to put a GoPro on your head.
And that's it. It's an uncut 10-minute sequence of just free fall footage.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there was one time as a kid where I went to Adventureland and it was pretty much empty because of the time we went there. We had those like wristband passes. So me and my friend just kept going on the roller coaster again and again and again. And that's how I picture Tom Cruise doing these 30 skydives in one day where he just lands, then he gets right back in the plane and immediately jumps out again. I don't know how else to fit in 30 in a day.
Yeah, I think that's how it happens. It's just like a ride. You just keep riding over and over again.
Or maybe he has a really high airplane, then he skydives, lands on a slightly less high airplane, right, and then jumps out of that again. That's possible.
Yeah, they said 30 jumps in one day, but they didn't say how high the jumps were, right? So
that's true. He's jumping from 20 feet in the air.
Yeah.
Man, this is just like, you know, Tom Cruise, it's kind of cliche to say almost at this point that he is doing some amazing stunts and it's crazy that he's the front man lead actor and then doing these stunts on his own. But kind of have to say it again. And it seems like that is a gimmick that they're really banking on in terms of marketing. They spent a full 10 minutes of video talking about his stunts, like almost nothing about the movie itself, just saying, look at the crazy shit that Tom Cruise does.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, you're right. That is a huge marketing piece right there where Tom Cruise is going to do this crazy thing and you're going to watch as he accomplishes and makes it.
And you're going to eat it up. And they're right. They're eating it up. It's pretty awesome. Pretty cool.
It is. I'm wondering when they're making these movies, we talked to Wade a little bit, but if they actually plan out in advance sort of what the next thing is going to be and how crazy that thing is going to be next compared to the thing they did in the past. Because it seems they have to like one-up themselves every single time
creep. That's true. I feel like they probably don't. If anything, the limitations would probably be budget-wise or budget-oriented. I like to think they just go for broke each time and have to keep one-upping themselves in creative ways.
Yeah, we'll see. It sounds like a really fun process from especially what Wade was explaining, and I'm excited.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, next up we have the trailer for Spider-Man No Way Home. The views have smashed Avengers Endgame's all-time record. It has said that No Way Home racked up an all-time viewership record of 355.5 million global views in its first 24 hours, which has blown away Avengers Endgame, which drove 289 million views. So, wow, crazy. And there's also a lot of news about Alfred Molina coming back. You know, you probably got the Goblin coming back, Sandman, Electro possibly. We don't know.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the numbers are so big at this point for these kinds of franchises. You really can't even comprehend how big that is. Sometimes people will say, oh, I need 5 of these things. And then I say, oh, I can't even count that high as a joke. I probably literally couldn't count this high. 355.5 million, I would get lost along the way counting up to that number. It is insane. Yeah. Insane. And then all of these, you know, possible cameos. So all the extended universe stuff, I feel like sometimes it loses its glam factor after how many Marvel movies come out and then do crossovers and stuff like that. But this is the first one in a long time where I'm super excited to see these characters returning from not just another, you know, Marvel film, but from another iteration of it, right? From the Sam Raimi Spider-Man films where we have Alfred Molina coming up on screen again. I feel like all of those nostalgia-driven, you know, returning film franchises have been for an age bracket that is a little bit older than us. So stuff from the 80s or 90s, it's Ghostbusters or otherwise. But for us, or for me at least, specifically, seeing these characters come back, this is the era that really defined my childhood personally, which is, again, those Sam Raimi Spider-Man films. Very, very excited about that.
I saw a comment or something where someone was like, yeah, I was 5 years old when I think the first one came out or something like that. And now I'm 21.
Yeah,
something crazy like that. And it's nuts because you're right. It is really catering to that older audience. And I think a lot of it is. And at least the kids nowadays, if they haven't seen, you know, the older Spider-Mans with Sam Raimi, it's might not resonate as well. But it's really cool that they're going to get introduced to these characters that we grew up with as well.
I could talk about those Sam Raimi films for
forever,
basically. So
it's so cool, though, that, I mean, Sam Raimi is now doing the new Doctor Strange Multiverse of Madness.
That's right. That's true.
And at the same time that this Spider-Man's getting released. So it's crazy that, you know, he's coming to the Marvel Universe. I'm really excited to see what he does as well.
Yes.
This film in particular, I'm very excited for possible Tobey Maguire return and Andrew Garfield. I don't know if it's going to happen, but there have been like leaks and rumors and whatnot about possibly the three kind of coming together at some point in the movie. I don't know how true it is, but that would be just crazy to hear.
At this point, that's the biggest worry, is the hype is so high and everyone's imaginations are running wild that right. If it doesn't hit every single checkbox that we set out for it, or at least tease at its possibility in the future, then people might be a little bit disappointed. But it seems like they got a lot of stuff going for it.
Yeah, I mean, Tobey Maguire really hasn't done a whole lot since, you know, Spider-Man. He did The Great Gatsby, obviously. He did another film or something like that, but he should definitely come back.
Yeah, he definitely had a long hiatus, definitely.
Yeah, it would just be crazy. And I know like the comments are just filled with Tobey Maguire comments, pizza time and all that stuff. So
pizza time, yeah.
There's also this possible arc of him becoming like a sort of mentor figure for this version of Spider-Man. So that might be kind of cool too.
Yeah, Marvel likes to get kind of meta with that a lot, I feel like, in terms of relationships between actors, kind of reflecting the relationships in the film.
Yeah. Another thing I noticed was Alfred Molina is actually much older now. And in the trailer, he was looking kind of young. So they used some de-aging technology there, I think.
I wonder if it is a fully CG recreation or putting his face on another actor, or if they did bring him back onto the project to do some on-screen work, because I haven't seen anything from him.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that I've seen is saying Alfred Molina's Doc Ock as opposed to Alfred Molina as Doc Ock. So I don't know what's confirmed about how invested he is, or how deeply he is with this project. Let me see.
Oh, I'm pretty sure he is. I saw on his IMDb, like, he is listed as Doc Ock. So I'm pretty sure that he's playing the role now.
Yeah. Oh, you're right. Yeah. Yeah. Invited to reprise his role. Okay.
Yes. There is also that Green Goblin, the bomb that he uses.
Yeah.
And they're in the laugh too. I mean, bringing William Dafoe back probably is very possible too.
Super possible. Yeah. I feel like kind of like you were saying before with Mission Impossible, might be something that they're saving for a sequel or some other Spider-Man film to bring back William Dafoe. Top tier A-list actor, William Dafoe. Man, let me just say, Sam Raimi
seen The Lighthouse?
Did those villains.
Man.
Oh my God, The Lighthouse was crazy with him and Robert Pattinson.
Yeah.
Pattinson?
Robert Pattinson.
Okay, there you go. Those two guys. Awesome stuff. Yeah, Sam Raimi really did those villains justice. He was able to keep some of the campiness of the comic books to those villains while also really fleshing them out and giving them some real character depth, similar to what we've heard about the Shang-Chi villain and the Shang-Chi film. But super impressed with that film franchise, as you could probably tell.
Yeah. All right, next up we have Netflix fall movie announcements. This is actually pretty crazy because Netflix is coming out with about 43 films for the final 4 months of 2021.
I can't even count that high.
Yeah, it's crazy.
See what I was talking about? Yeah.
Yeah. And some of them include action movies, one of them being Kate, which is coming out on the 10th, I believe, of September. It stars Mary Elizabeth Winstead as an assassin who has 24 hours to get vengeance on her murderer before she dies. Kind of crazy because I've seen her in Scott Pilgrim and stuff like that, but now she's doing an action movie. So
yeah, she
that's
did
pretty
get,
awesome.
Get to kick some butt in Scott Pilgrim as well. Actually, yeah. I did not know the premise was she has 24 hours to get vengeance before she dies. I feel like they didn't really communicate that in the trailer.
Yeah.
And that is a pretty bomb tagline. That is pretty good.
And I also saw it was produced by David Leitch, obviously, you know, like I mentioned before, Fast Furious, you know, he's done a whole bunch of stuff, Nobody. So it's really cool to see him in a producing role and doing more of these Netflix films. That's really cool. Next up, we have Army of Thieves, which is Zack Snyder's prequel to Army of the Dead. It is going to be set for release, it says, October 29th.
Yeah, I have not seen exciting. Army of the Dead. I heard it was pretty good, but like you were saying when we were just talking before off mic, it feels like Army of the Dead just came out and he's already pumping out another one. That is,
I know, it's crazy. It's crazy to have two blockbuster films, man, coming out in 1 year. That's
nuts. It's in the same year. That's insane.
Yeah, and especially, you know, obviously the Justice League getting re-released under the Snyder Cut. It's great to see him, you know, coming back to the directing role and doing more there.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Next up, we have Netflix's Cowboy Bebop live action series sets premiere date. John Cho as Spike Spiegel unveiled in first looked images. Yep. This was an article written by Alexandra Del Rosario on Deadline. The article says, Cowboy Bebop, after the long and winding road of production, has finally touched down on Netflix. The streamer unveiled the premiere date and first look images for its live-action series starring John Cho. Based on Shinichiro Watanabe's cult anime series, Cowboy Bebop follows a group of misfit bounty hunters led by Spike Spiegel, who's played by Cho, as they search for the galaxy's most valuable criminals. Mustafa Shakir also stars as Spike's trusted co-pilot, Jet Black, and Daniela Pineda as the highly skilled bounty hunter, Faye Valentine. The series will debut on Netflix Friday, November 19th.
Have you seen the Cowboy Bebop series?
I haven't, actually.
Okay. I just finished the series a couple weeks ago. I didn't see
really?
There's an anime movie that I haven't seen yet, but it's pretty amazing. It's pretty top tier anime storytelling here. Just one season. I think it'll lend itself very well to this Netflix 10 episode format.
Mm-hmm.
And the screen caps here, or the first look images, they look pretty faithful, all things considered, to the original series.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I've definitely heard a lot about is John Cho's age. So he's 49. And
yeah.
Spike, the character, is apparently 27 in the anime. I didn't know he had canonical age there, but
right.
That did concern me as well. I know that in terms of his story in the anime, it seems pretty important that he's kind of young and on the cusp of growing into a more mature adulthood. It seems like that is part of his characterization. So
yeah, it's kind of crazy because I've seen John Cho in movies like Searching, and he's played a father in those movies already, and he's kind of hopping into these older roles, as you'd say, and now he's jumping into a younger role. And there are a lot of questions about that, but I think he did address in an article before that his greatest concern was the physical part of the role, because obviously he's probably not as agile as he was when he was, you know, 27 years old, but hopefully, you know, he'll be able to do everything that's required physically to make it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, age stuff aside, I have full faith in John Cho. He's a really good actor. Loved him in Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle. But yeah, I have faith in John Cho, ultimately.
He doesn't look 49.
He does not.
And he doesn't look 49.
That is a pattern for a lot of Asian people.
Yeah, yeah. We don't look that old, right?
Yeah, Asians don't raisin. That's what they say.
Asians don't raisin. Yeah, exactly. And lastly, we have The Matrix 4, Every Question Answered After the First Resurrections Footage. This was an article written by Daniel DiMana from Screen Rant. The article states, the first footage from The Matrix Resurrections answers several lingering questions about the sequel, while also keeping the action movie's larger details hidden. The Matrix 4 has remained the most mysterious blockbuster film release of 2021. With much of its story still under wraps, just a few months before it hits theaters, a full trailer also has yet to appear to be released. But thanks to the footage revealed at CinemaCon, some of the mystique surrounding the film is beginning to dissipate. The first question is Yahya Abdul-Mateen II really Morpheus? One of the largest curiosities surrounding The Matrix Resurrections has to do with the character Morpheus, played in the original trilogy by Lawrence Fishburne. Despite surviving through the events of Revolutions, Fishburne wasn't cast in Resurrections, and the actor has maintained that he will not be appearing as Morpheus in the film. This has led to speculation that actor Yahya Abdul-Mateen II will be inheriting the role, possibly playing a younger version of the franchise's iconic hero. The second question is, how are Neo and Trinity alive? Another huge source of speculation surrounding the fourth Matrix film is the return of Neo and Trinity, both who died during the events of the third movie. While this big question remains mostly unanswered, the new footage includes one interesting revelation. Neither Neo nor Trinity seem to remember who they are or that they've met, or that they live within a simulation. The teaser included a scene of the two meeting and shaking hands in a coffee shop, during which time a moment deja vu appears to strike them. And the third question is, who is controlling the Matrix now, with the Architects actor Helmut Bacatus not confirmed to make an appearance. The fact that the simulation is still around might imply that the new program has assumed control of the world. Perhaps this new Matrix program deleted the Architect and refused to unplug the human prisoners, instead resetting the program to its neutral state. And the last question is there more to Neil Patrick Harris's character? One new actor to join the Matrix franchise is Neil Patrick Harris, whose character has remained mysterious since his casting was announced. In the CinemaCon footage, Harris is seen acting as a doctor or perhaps therapist to the man named Thomas, who is revealed to be Neo. Harris's character prescribes the blue pills to Thomas, seemingly confirming his status as the villain of The Matrix 4.
Yeah, and so to be clear, this is a behind closed doors sort of press only first look, right?
Yes.
We lowly public consumers cannot see these images just yet.
So we only have these slight leaks about what happened, but hopefully a trailer will be dropping soon and it'll answer all these questions.
Hopefully, yeah. Do we have a release for it yet?
I don't know if there is a specific release date. It seems to be one of those movies that people have said have been really, really kind of quiet for the past couple of years, especially in production. And no one has really said anything about it. The studios haven't released much about it. Keanu obviously hasn't said much about it. So we don't really know. We just know that it's happening. So we'll have to see.
Looking forward to it. I need to rewatch. I really only saw the first one a long time ago, and I have not watched 2 or 3.
All right. So I guess that's it for our news segment. Now we're going to be moving on to the Shang-Chi breakdown.
项链交出来. You have the wrong guy. Does he look like he can fight? Come on, bro.
So, the Shang-Chi fight from this clip that was released a couple days ago, or at least a week ago, I think, at the time of this recording. But it was pretty awesome when I first saw it. I almost couldn't believe that they released this long of a clip as a teaser.
Yeah. So this is showing a bit from a bus fight scene. I know in different trailers and behind the scenes footage, it looks like there's some more bus related action that happens maybe after this. But right here, we get about a minute and 4 seconds worth of some real martial arts heavy action between our hero Shang-Chi, played by Simu Liu, and some three henchmen.
Yeah, and the fight starts out very, very Jackie Chan-esque. You can definitely see Andy Chang's sort of his style there a little bit. Immediately enters Jackie Chan mode. I don't want any trouble.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah, I think that first strike, though, so awesome, because I think that's the realization, right, that for at least Awkwafina's character, that this Shang-Chi guy can fight.
Yeah. And even before that, so you have the scene set up, like you're saying, where he's saying, don't want any trouble. We get that there's some sort of MacGuffin going on where the bad guys are saying, I want the pendant. And you see that there's a pendant around his neck on a necklace. There's two goons holding him, one on each arm. And then he's able to break away once one of the henchmen starts giving Awkwafina some trouble, right? Awkwafina talks back to him, says, you know, it's the wrong guy. Do you think this guy can fight? Bad guy talks back to Awkwafina, pushes her down. And then you have Simu Liu's character breaking away from those henchmen and then doing that really sweet power stance, single punch, sending the guy flying back through the bus. You get the beat coming in the background, the music cue. And then the action really starts. Then, like you said, you have that Awkwafina beat of, oh my God, this guy can fight. I'm very confused. And throughout the scene, you'll see they get a lot of mileage in terms of comedy out of how different people react to this crazy martial arts fight scene that's going on in this public place, this public transportation.
Yeah, it definitely adds a lot to the comedy. I love the sort of comedic beats that they have here, just from people reacting to him, the dude saying he's going to break down the fight or something like that.
Yeah,
I was
yeah,
like, Cliff. That's definitely
that's
a
us.
Nod. That's definitely us. Yeah.
Yeah. That was an interesting bit with Cliff, because I feel like usually if you have an action scene going on here and then the director says, okay, now we need to cut away to some comedic beat elsewhere, usually you're going to lose some of the action choreography in that cutaway, right? Mm-hmm. This one was unique because Cliff is filming it, right?
So yeah, he's recording
one where
it. Yeah.
Seeing from Cliff's point of view, we're seeing the action happening through the phone.
Mm.
So it's less of a break. You're still seeing all of the sweet hits that are happening even as we're with Cliff And we even get to...
You don't lose the momentum, for sure.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. You even get to do this nice zoom-in frame on the phone of this beautiful sort of split kick where Simulio jumps up, grabs the poles that are on the ceiling of the bus, and uses that to propel himself upwards. Again, just beautifully highlighted and sort of a frame within a frame on Cliff's phone. That was really interesting.
It's really cool because it adds also that sense of realism when a camera could be moving around and hiding certain things. Like someone obviously recording from a little farther away. You feel like it's more real, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Especially since it's a wider angle. You know, it's not trying to move in any particular kind of way. So I felt like it added more than it detracted from this fight scene. So
yeah. And it reminded me, you know, speaking of camera angles and things like that, for these kinds of martial arts fisticuffs fight scenes, there was a Rocket Jump video, again, huge YouTube Rocket Jump fans, where they were talking about super shaky cam, a lot of cuts and a lot of sort of poorly done American action movies where you can't really tell what's going on. And then in those Eastern or Hong Kong or Asian martial arts films, you have these really long extended takes where you get to really show off that your actors can do martial arts really well. And here I feel like you get a nice balance of the two where you get these, you know, Western action influenced different shots, different angles, like we said, a cutaway to Cliff's point of view. But then you're also getting some nice, not too shaky shots where you can really see some of the action take place in all its glory.
It's very evident that Simu Liu is doing a lot of this action, actually. You can see his face like very, very clearly in a lot of the shots, and he's moving so quickly. That's one thing that really stood out to me is that Shang-Chi moves very quick.
Yeah, definitely. And I was looking at some more behind the scenes videos and they name dropped a lot of Tai Chi and a lot of Wing Chun. And then they also said there's some other regional styles. Very Kung Fu influenced, with it being a sort of Chinese background. Kung Fu being a very catch-all umbrella term for basically any style of martial art that comes from China. So seeing those real world influences. And you definitely saw a lot of Wing Chun here in the choreography where he's, you know, trapping hands and centerline chain punching a la Donnie Yen's Ip Man. Another bit of action that I really enjoyed was him getting his jacket pulled off his shoulders, spinning around and being able to use it to trap the other guy's arms.
Yeah, that was a very...
Push him off and then put the jacket back on.
That's a very Jackie Chan thing, the jacket, man.
Oh, yeah.
That's like almost like a signature Jackie move, I feel like. Having the guy hooked on with the jacket behind you. I think he did that in Rumble in the Bronx, too. One of the fight scenes. But I think even more than just that, him putting the jacket back on was so smooth.
Yeah, mid-fight, yeah. It was awesome. I feel like this is really a strategically picked scene to put out into the world. It's not super crazy, big, high-budget explosion action where you want to save that for the film audience when they sit down and see the film for the first time. But it's also, it's kind of restoring some faith that people might have, where it's reassuring you, like, we know action,
we know what we're doing.
Martial arts choreography justice. You know, the Jackie Chan influence and the old school, you know, again, the Donnie Yen sort of Wing Chun influence, and we're going to execute it really well.
Yeah, and it doesn't reveal that much either. It's like, it kind of tells you already what you know, other than, oh, these guys are looking for this necklace that he has.
Yeah.
But other than that, it doesn't reveal too much without, you know, spoiling the film.
That's true. And I wouldn't be surprised if that necklace has a little more of a spotlight in the rest of the sequence, because they really do set it up in the beginning where the bad guy's goal isn't just to kill this guy, it's to get this pendant from his necklace. So might see that in the full cut of the scene. Another thing that I really liked is the use of the bus as a space. One thing that happens in particular early on is he's able to get a guy to keel over. And then instead of being able to run around him to reinforce the fact that it's this cramped bus setting, he actually has to grab onto the guy and then run up the wall to go pretty much over the guy instead of being able to walk around him because there's no room. Then he can use that momentum and flip the guy, smash him into the seat of a bus. But
yeah, there's a lot of advantages to having a little bit of a smaller space. Like, it's almost a hallway fight if you really think about it.
Yeah, but with more poles and stuff.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Another thing from the camera work side of things I noticed is this use of slow motion mixed with normal speed, you know, parts of the fight. It really adds something because, you know, sometimes you need to slow down and really look at those details. And this scene really did it well with the slow motion punch at the beginning and obviously the slow motion dodge where the guy's grabbing for the necklace.
That's true. You can really highlight and zoom in on some of those small moments that you might miss in that real-time footage.
Yeah, I really like the pole smash where he's going and the guy ducks around the other side of the pole and he just smashes him through it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That was good. Again, using that bus environment. And then I believe right after that is when he sits down and then there's this girl who's super shell-shocked about what's going on. He kind of just waves high.
So yeah, in a little flirty way, but you know.
A little bit. I mean, it's Sima Leo. If you see him, you got to flirt with him.
Of course, yeah.
And then we end the scene's action, at least, with this gorgeous jump sort of split kick where he's kicking two guys in the face at the same time. One with each leg.
That's crazy. It's like, it's a full split, right? Essentially a full split in the air.
It might as well be. I mean, it's sort of like a front split as opposed to a side split. And his legs are a little bent, but. No, you're right. That is a full split. Now that I'm viewing the footage.
Yeah.
You pause that frame, his legs are going straight out.
Yeah, and that's crazy. I wonder how many times it took them to get that right. Or maybe we'll hear later on that, you know, there was some other trickery there. But I don't know.
As possible. As possible.
Looks really cool.
I feel like with the dedication they put into this, they brought some sort of Tai Chi world champion or something like that as an advisor. They have some top tier talent and some deep cuts in terms of specialists. So I would not be surprised if he did a midair split kick.
Yeah. Again, big shout out to people that worked on this scene. If I can remember them from name, is Brad Allen, the late Brad Allen, Andy Chang. You got Joseph Lay. You got V. Dunn. You have Riven, which is Christopher Cowan. And the last one, you got Young Lee as action designers.
Yeah. Did we mention Joseph Lee as well?
Yeah. Joseph Lee. Yep.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah. I don't know who did what scene or how they split up the work, but all of those people contributed to the awesome action that we're seeing from this film.
Yeah. And obviously, I was looking at some of Chris's early work, at least, because he started on YouTube as well as Young. And some of their stuff is kind of crazy. He did this Naruto fight. He did the UALA series on YouTube as well. Stuff that Corder also covered quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
He's worked with Guy De Silva. You know, he's been in so many things at this point. Stunt double for Black Panther, a whole bunch of stuff. So.
Yeah,
really, really cool to see YouTubers kind of break into this fight scene.
Young Lee was a big rocket jump contributor from some of their later skits as well. There's this one really long take for this skit called Tip Jar, and it's this black and white silent film era style action thing that he helped choreograph, and it is fantastic. Highly recommend checking that out. Really cool stuff from all these Shang-Chi veterans.
Yeah. And like I said, they all started sort of online and doing their own films, especially V. Dan. I think he did a Cyberpunk 2077 film as well.
I remember seeing that.
It was really good. It was like really, really well done. Everything was like top notch. And just seeing Hollywood acknowledge, you know, these guys is just incredible.
Taking over the world.
Yeah. All right. Thank you guys so much for listening to this episode. And yeah, catch us next week for another interview.
If you liked that, please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/actionfilmmaking and leaving a review on Apple Podcasts. Stay up to date on the show by visiting our website, actiondecoded.com, and by following us on Instagram at actionfilmmakingpodcast. Until next time, thanks for listening.